The history of Montreal is built with each of our lives. Everybody plays a role, small or large, in the past as in the present. The people we will tell you about did their part. They laid the groundwork for what our city has become today.
Charles Lemoyne and Jacques Lebert, friends and brothers-in-law. The history of Montreal in the 17th century was marked by the personalities of two unusual men, Charles Lemoyne and Jacques Lebert. They arrived after the founding of the city and were both brothers-in-law and partners. The two of them had a formidable sense of business and became the richest men in the city. Charles Lemoyne was originally from Dieppe, France. He arrived in New France in 1641 at the age of 15. He was an indentured employee of the Jesuits for their Huron mission and lived in Sainte-Marie among the Hurons, near Georgian Bay, for 4 years. He quickly learned to speak the languages of the First Nations people. His talent as an interpreter was a strategic asset for him in the fur trade and later for the diplomatic strategy in which he played an important role. In 1646, Charles Lemoyne settled definitively in Ville-Marie, which later became Montreal. He was one of the military leaders of the small village. In 1654, following his marriage to Catherine Thierry, Chomedey de Maisonneuve gave Lemoyne a concession for 90 acres of land on the southwest point, which took the name Pointe Saint-Charles at that time. Later, Charles Lemoyne was involved in the development of his seigneuries. He had 12 sons, 10 of whom played illustrious roles in the history of New France. He died in February 1685 and was buried in the crypt of the Église Notre-Dame in Montreal. His sister, Jeanne Lemoyne, married Jacques Lebert, originally from Rouen. She arrived here in 1657. Jacques Lebert was an exceptional businessman. He partnered with Charles in a very profitable fur trade business. They established fur trading posts beyond the secure limits of Montreal, such as the one in Lachine, which they had built in 1669, as well as the one in Senneville. Jacques Lebert was one of the most influential individuals of his time. He was given a noble title in 1696 and died in 1706. He owned lands in Pointe-Saint-Charles, as did his brother, François Lebert, who built the house that Marguerite Bourgeois purchased from him in 1668. That house is now Maison Saint-Gabriel, museum and historical site.
Marguerite Bourgeois and Catherine Crollo, remarkable women. Several women played a major role in the founding of Montreal. First, there was Jeanne Mance, who arrived with Paul Chomedey, Sieur de Maisonneuve, on May 18, 1642. She founded the Hôtel Dieu, the first hospital in Ville-Marie. Then, in 1653, Marguerite Bourgeois arrived to serve as the first teacher. She opened her school in a stable and welcomed all of the children of the first settlers and the First Nations people, boys and girls, rich and poor. She dreamed of founding a non-cloistered religious community, something that didn't exist at that time. But for her, that was the only way she could complete the mission she had taken on. Looking for help to fulfill this vision, she returned to France to find other women who wanted to take part in this adventure. Catherine Crollo came back with her in 1659. This robust, energetic woman took charge of daily management. Her energy was proverbial. She initiated and supervised the clearing of the land and the planting of the first crops on the farm in the Point, as it was called then. She hired the first families that lived on the farm and helped the nuns grow crops and raise animals. She also welcomed the king's wards and introduced them to life here. As a result of the revenue generated by the farm, Marguerite Bourgeois obtained her letters patent from King Louis XIV in 1670. Marguerite Bourgeois and Catherine Crollo both lived to a very old age for that time, namely 80. Catherine Crollo passed away in 1699 and Marguerite Bourgeois in 1700. Following that, over the centuries, 86 women managed the farm. They are called sharecroppers because they did not manage the farm for their own profit, but for the benefit of the community. They witnessed good years with generous harvests, as well as wars, catastrophes, and finally, industrialization. During the course of the 19th century, the land was broken up into parcels and sold. The farm stopped its activities in 1960. Maison Saint-Gabriel became a museum in 1966, and it is still managed by women. Gabrielle Roy, writer. The writer Gabrielle Roy published her first novel in 1945 entitled Bonheur d'Occasion. It was an almost immediate success. The entire story of Bonheur d'Occasion is set in the neighborhoods that now make up the Sud-Ouest borough. In May 1947, her novel was selected as the Book of the Month by the Literary Guild of America. In December 1947, in Paris, she received the Prix Femina, the first time a Canadian author had received a major French literary award. This novel, which is magnificently written, literally makes us relive the daily lives of people of that time. Hopes, despairs, love, family solidarity, and the fight against poverty. Gabrielle passionately loved the St. Lawrence River and this corner of Montréal. When she returned from France, she spent 2 years with her husband in the Bronx neighborhood in La Salle, near the river.
Toll stories. Do you think the roads in Montreal are in poor condition? Well, you would be happy not to have lived in Montreal during the 18th and 19th centuries. The roads were often poorly maintained. In fact, each landowner had to maintain the section of road that crossed his land, whether he used it or not, in keeping with the seigneurial system. At the beginning of the 19th century, the village road inspector suggested that the roads be transformed into toll roads. This only happened in 1840, with the implementation of a new system and the creation of the Montreal Turnpike Trust, later called the Tollgate Commission. It maintained these roads and built new ones. The toll roads were of better quality than the other roads. In this way, the Chemin du Roi, one of the most traveled roads, became one of the first toll roads on the island. The company was authorized to collect a toll from anyone and any vehicle leaving or entering the city. Gates were located at the edges of the city, to the east, north, and west. In 1840, a toll gate was erected on the north side of Wellington Street near Charlevoix Street. According to the Lois et Ordonnances des Syndics des Chemins à Barrières, tolls collected to come and go between midnight of one day and midnight of the next day with the same horse or the same horses or the same cart were based on the type of vehicle, the team, the load carried, and the size of the wheels. The rates for narrow wheels were, in fact, higher since they damaged the road more. This system was abolished in 1922 by the provincial government when the responsibility for roads was transferred to the Quebec government and to the municipalities. The Montreal Turnpike Trust ceased its operations at that time. Joseph Chapman, brewer. Under the French regime, wine imported from Spain was very popular, mixed with water. Cider was made with apples from the apple trees planted by the first colonists as soon as they arrived. Under the British regime, that would change, because the British preferred beer. Many brewers, therefore, appeared on the scene, spurred on by British merchants and soldiers who came to settle in Quebec City and Montreal following the Seven Years' War. The clientele for this fermented beverage grew at a spectacular rate. after nearly 10,000 loyalists arrived in the province of Quebec. The brewers of French origin adapted not only to the new socioeconomic realities, while expanding their clientele, but also benefited from the technological innovations and expertise of the British. It did not take long to notice this rapid development, as the 1827 census of industries in Lower Canada counted 14 breweries, including that of Joseph Chapman. Chapman was born in 1772, probably in the United States. Following the American Revolution, Joseph Chapman, like 10,000 other loyalists, applied to immigrate to Canada in 1789. The first mention of Chapman in Montreal dates back to 1797. During his lifetime, Joseph Chapman worked in a number of fields as a merchant tailor, a landowner, a supplier of construction materials for the government, and, lastly, as a beer brewer. He also tried his luck in politics, where he ran against Louis-Joseph Papineau in March 1820 and lost. His many real estate properties included Maison Nivard de Saint-Dizier, which he owned from 1820 until he died on May 4th, 1839. John Smythe Hall, first mayor of Verdun. John Smythe Hall was elected councillor of the municipality of Rivière-Saint-Pierre at the first public council meeting on February 8, 1875, held at the Pavilion. A week later, on February 15, a mayor was chosen among the councillors, as was standard practice at the time. And that was how John Smythe Hall was proclaimed mayor of the new municipality. It was his son, John S. Hall, who went on to become a renowned lawyer, who took the minutes of that historic meeting. Under Mayor Hall, who held this position until 1882, the municipality changed its name to Verdun. Hall established a policy to regulate a number of matters. On April 13, 1875, the sale of alcoholic beverages was prohibited, subject to a fine of $50 or a maximum 3-month prison sentence. That was how Verdun became a dry city, in a bylaw that was abolished only in 2015. Moreover, companies producing foul-smelling products, or those settling on Verdun territory without having first obtained the municipality's permission, were subject to fines and imprisonment. Joseph Arsène Richard, founder of the Christ Roi Hospital. Joseph Arsène Richard, better known as Monseigneur Richard, was born on September 19, 1859, in Saint-Liguerie de Montcalm. Of Acadian descent, he was the fourth in a family of 11 children, including 4 girls who decided to become nuns. It must be borne in mind that in big families in those days, it wasn't rare for a number of children to become priests, missionaries, or nuns. In fact, we can't even imagine today how strong people's faith was then and to what extent their values were tied to the Catholic religion. Richard studied at Collège L'Assomption and then at Collège de Joliette, where he graduated with a Bachelor of Arts degree. He was ordained as a priest on March 17, 1889. First, he became Saint-Barthélemy's assistant priest, and then the same at Saint-Paul-l'Ermite in 1891, and at Saint-Enfant-Jésus in 1897, before becoming parish priest in 1899 at Notre-Dame-des-Sept-Douleurs parish in Verdun, a little municipality of 2,000 inhabitants. He was 40 years old at the time, with lots of energy and a vision of what the municipality needed in terms of education and healthcare. It should be noted that when he retired some 30 years later, Verdun had more than 60,000 residents. Monseigneur Richard was involved in a number of projects, including the establishment of Christ Roi Hospital, today the Verdun Hospital. Monseigneur Richard died on June 17, 1945, at the age of 86. Yeah.
The bomb girls. Workers at the Verdun munitions factory. When the First and Second World Wars broke out, many men had to leave their jobs after being drafted into the army. This caused a labor shortage at the various factories, so employers hired thousands of women to meet the population's needs. Those who produced military equipment were called the bomb girls. These women worked relentlessly to contribute to the war effort and also to provide for their own families. In Verdun, during World War II, the munitions factory employed 6,805 workers, mostly women. Here is the testimony of Guy Billard, son of Jeanne Sleven Billard, a bomb girl at the Verdun munitions factory.
George Buzz Burling, aviator and war hero. Some Verdunites became national heroes in World War II. That was the case of pilot officer George F. Burling. Interested in aviation, Burling enlisted in the Royal Air Force in 1940. During a military campaign in Malta, this pilot succeeded in gunning down 27 enemy aircraft, including two, in 10 seconds. Following Burling's injury in October 1942, the Army showed its gratitude to him by granting him a promotion and naming him Knight of Malta. When he was recalled to Canada in 1942, the federal government called upon his services for war propaganda purposes. On November 10, 1942, Burling returned to Verdun and the city organized a big ceremony for him at the Verdun Auditorium. Over 6,300 Verdunites attended these festivities, which were broadcast live on radio all over Canada. Burling went back to the front lines in 1943. Credited with shooting down 31 enemy aircraft, he was considered one of the best pilots in World War II. Following the war, unable to readjust to civilian life and always looking for adventure, he joined the Air Force of the New State of Israel, which was at war at the time in an effort to gain its independence from the neighboring Arab countries. On May 20th, 1948, he crashed while taking off from Rome, Italy, flying an old aircraft bought from American surplus and filled with weapons and explosives for Israel. He was 26 at the time. Hockey and Maurice Richard. There is still a lot of controversy around the origins of hockey. Several countries claim to be the one that first introduced this sport. However, a number of historians agree that the first indoor hockey game was played in Montreal. It was on the evening of March 3rd, 1875, at the Victoria Skating Rink. Hockey rapidly became popular among Quebecers and Canadians in general. And quickly, too, a system of clubs and tournaments developed, and a number of teams were formed in Canada and the United States. In Montreal, six teams were created, each of which won the Stanley Cup at least twice, including the Montreal Canadiens, founded in 1909. Nicknamed the Rocket, Maurice Richard is one of the world's best-known hockey players. He made his debut at the age of 17 in the junior hockey world and played for the Verdun Maple Leafs for two seasons, 1938 to 1939 and 1939 to 1940. During the 1939-40 season, he played only 10 regular season games and 11 during the playoffs. In those 21 games, Maurice Richard scored 17 goals and made 13 assists for a total of 30 points. The following year, he signed a contract with the Senior Canadians, the farm team of Les Canadiens de Montréal, Incorporated. Over the course of his career with the Montreal Canadiens, Maurice Richard won 8 Stanley Cups and was awarded many honors.
Étienne Campeau and Catherine Polo. first inhabitants of Verdun. Out of the 8 colonists known as the Argoulets, very few of them remained in the territory of Verdun. Most of them moved to neighboring villages, including Lachine. Among those who stayed, one of them never left Côte des Argoulets, Étienne Campeau. He was said to be born in 1635 in Brive-la-Gaillarde in Limousin, today the département de Corrèze in the south of France, the son of Léonard Campeau and Françoise Monger. He arrived in New France in the early 1660s. It was in 1663 that his name appeared in Ville-Marie's archives when, together with several Montréalistes, the first inhabitants of Montreal, he enlisted in the Sainte-Famille Militia. In 1663, he was hired along with François Lebert to clear the Lemoine family's land, which was later transferred to Marguerite Bourgeois. Today, this land corresponds to the site of Maison Saint-Gabriel. It is probably at that location that he met Catherine Pollot, his future wife. Catherine Pollot was one of the first 36 King's wards to disembark in Montreal. These girls were sent by the King of France to take husbands here and populate the colony. Étienne and Catherine's marriage took place on November 13th, 1663, and over the years the couple had 15 children. In 1665, at the request of Maisonneuve, the couple settled in Côte des Argoulets to create a defensive outpost. In return, they were granted a plot of land measuring 2 acres along the river by 15 acres in depth. They were among the first inhabitants of Verdun. Étienne Campeau died in 1692. One of his descendants later settled in the United States and became an ancestor of Hillary Clinton.
Crossing the river.
Without a bridge?
It's not easy at that time. In winter, in some locations, there was an ice bridge that formed at certain times, but in summer, ferries were needed. And of course, they weren't free. There was a ferry crossing between Verdun and La Prairie. The fares? In 1879, Henri Pigeon's ferry operating permit indicates the price of the crossings. For a vehicle, one way, over 40 cents. For a return trip, 60 cents and 15 cents. For a person on foot, a return trip was 25 cents. For a horse and rider, 25 cents one way and 40 cents for a return trip. For a horned animal, or adult bovid, 20 cents per crossing, a sheep, calf, or pig, 10 cents. In 1880, the proceeds from this permit were shared between the municipalities of Verdun and La Prairie. The ferries provided work for many people who developed incredible skill in river navigation, like Captain P. McLean, owner of Vapeur Saint-Louis. McLean was a sailor who was employed 26 years by the Richelieu Company in Ontario aboard the ship La Prairie. He then resigned and bought a steamboat called the Saint-Louis, with which he shuttled back and forth between Verdun and La Prairie on a daily basis. In 1908, his boat made 4 trips every day of the week and 6 trips on Sundays. Dr. James Douglas, founder of the Douglas Institute. Around the end of the 19th century, the need to establish an institution providing psychiatric treatment based on a humanistic approach was voiced by the Protestant community. On June 30, 1881, the Quebec government adopted the Act of Incorporation of the Protestant Hospital for the Insane, and that's how the Douglas Institute was created. Dr. James Douglas played a key role in the hospital's first years as it gradually became established. He ardently defended the notion that people suffering from mental disease needed a healthy environment with a complete work and recreational program. This philosophy had a profound impact on the hospital's approach, as well as on the care and treatment given to patients. Dr. James Douglas's generous donations to the hospital enabled it to survive in times of financial difficulties. From its very beginnings, the hospital had to rely on the community for its development. Since it was not run by a religious organization, as was the case of most Francophone hospitals, it had to rely more on the public's generosity and volunteer work. This culture of openness and partnership with the community, in fact, made it possible to successfully carry out various social reintegration projects. Dr. James Douglas and his team stated that appropriately occupying people is one of the keys to treating and curing most forms of mental health problems. The patients were therefore encouraged to work at the hospital. Already in 1895, 65% of the patients worked there in a wide variety of jobs, ranging from harvesting to painting to mending clothes. The hospital also operated a farm on its grounds where the patients worked. John Crawford, businessman and hunting enthusiast. John Crawford was born in Ireland on February 25, 1814. He emigrated to Canada in 1829 at the age of 15. John Crawford became a prominent and wealthy Montreal businessman who was the vice president of the Molson Bank, president of City Passenger Railway Company, and director of Montreal Gas Company and Montreal Turnpike Trust. On September 28, 1837, he married Mary Elizabeth Molson, the niece of the renowned John Molson. They had three children together. In 1864, John Crawford then married Margaret Davidson Elgood, with whom he had four children. In 1842, he purchased the fief of Verdun, where he built a Victorian-style house called Verdun House, and used Maison Nivard de Saint-Dizier as a hunting camp. John Crawford also chaired the first public meeting of the municipality of Rivière-Saint-Pierre and served as a Verdun city councillor from 1894 to 1901. John Crawford died on April 5, 1903. René Robert Cavelier de La Salle, explorer at heart. A great explorer of North America, famed for discovering the mouth of the Mississippi River, René Robert Cavelier de La Salle was born in Rouen, France, in 1643. He entered the Jesuit order to please his father, but his sights were set on adventure. After arriving in Montreal in 1667 as the son of a wealthy family, he was granted a concession of land by the Sulpician priests who held the Seigneurie of Montreal Island. His fiefdom, which he called Côte Saint-Sulpice, roughly covered the area of present-day La Salle borough. In 1669, La Salle's restless nature and urge to discover new territories spurred him to sell most of his land back to the Saint-Sulpice Seminary. Other tracts were bought by Jean Milo, an edge tool maker from the Saint-Pierre River area, and by the fur traders Charles Lemoine and Jacques Lebert. La Salle's early voyages led him to explore stretches of the Ohio River and the Great Lakes region. He reached the southern shore of Lake Michigan in 1680, and in 1682 traveled down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico, where he claimed the area for Louis XIV and named it Louisiana in his honor. In 1684, he set out from France on his last expedition, intending to reach the Mississippi Delta via the Gulf of Mexico. But the voyage was fraught with problems and ended in a double disaster. La Salle was murdered by his men, who in turn were massacred by local native people. The Peniston brothers, dairy farmers. In 1889, Francis Henry Peniston and his brothers Samuel, Albert Edward, and Charles Wilkes purchased 108 arpents of land located opposite the Lachine Rapids. There, the four brothers built a family home, which is still there today, and operated a dairy farm called Peniston Brothers. From 1893 to 1933, it served the neighboring cities and Westmount in particular. In 1931, the company had a capital estimated between $50,000 and $75,000, which was huge at the time. Francis Henry Penniston was elected city councillor in 1913, at the same time as Cecil Platt Newman became mayor, both for a two-year term of office. In particular, Penniston voted in favor of the acquisition in 1914 of Maison Brunning in order to set up the city hall of the new city of La Salle. In 1928, the Pennistons sold a parcel of their property to the city of Montreal, which wanted to facilitate the drinking water supply. The $87,618 price obtained for the transaction proved to be more than reasonable.
Alice Lussier, a woman of action. Born in 1926, Alice Lussier remained an ardent volunteer all her life within what was called the Bronx District, located near the Lachine Rapids. A columnist for Le Messager La Salle weekly newspaper for a number of years, Alice Lussier was the co-founder of the Comité de Citoyens du Village des Rapides, a non-profit organization devoted to preserving and stimulating the district. Since the Bronx District had an English name, efforts were made to rename it. The city of La Salle accepted the proposal submitted by the Comité de Citoyens in 1984, and the name of Village des Rapides became official. Alice Lussier was also one of the residents who wanted to preserve Notre-Dame du Sacré-Cœur Elementary School, which in 1986 became the Centre Culturel et Communautaire Henri Lemieux. Alice Lussier witnessed the transformation of the district and the development of the riverbanks near the Lachine Rapids. Up until the time she died, she defended the preservation of the built heritage in the district, and the Penniston House in particular.
Sir Herbert Samuel Holt, founder of Montreal Light, Heat and Power. Herbert Samuel Holt was born in Dublin, Ireland, in 1856, and studied civil engineering there. Arriving in Canada in 1875, he then supervised the installation of railway tracks from 1883 to 1889. He was an excellent engineer, but, above all, a remarkable businessman. In 1901, he founded the Montreal Light, Heat and Power Company, which was created from the merger of Royal Electric and its subsidiaries, Montreal and St. Lawrence Light, Heat and Power, and Chambly Manufacturing, as well as from Montreal Gas Company. It was a beginning. 2 years later, he noted that the Lachine Rapids Hydraulic and Land Company had a 25-year exclusive contract with the major Shawinigan Water and Power Corporation. Wanting to acquire that firm, he succeeded in convincing seasoned businessmen, including Rodolphe Forget, to work with him to acquire the Lachine Rapids Hydraulic and Land Company, which would give Montreal Light, Heat and Power the monopoly over the distribution of electricity on the island of Montreal. This was done in 1903. At that time, only 10% of Montrealers had electricity at home. Herbert Samuel Holt was a member of a number of boards of directors of various corporations in Montreal, and particularly the Royal Bank of Canada, where he served as chairman from 1908 to 1934. Pascal Persillier dit La Chapelle, the miller's son. In the 1820s, Noël Pascal Persillier dit La Chapelle, Sr., a tanner and businessman, obtained operating leases for the mills in Lachine and Grosseau from the Sulpicians. During this time, he initiated the construction of a toll bridge. The layout looked like the one for La Chapelle Bridge currently spanning the Rivière des Prairies. Pascal Persillier de la Chapelle, Jr., born in 1806, studied to become a notary at Collège de Montréal. He married Émilie Leduc, dit Saint-Omer, in Montreal in 1826. That year, he answered his father's call to become the main miller and manager of the water mills in Lachine, which were long the most lucrative on the island of Montreal. On October 14, 1828, an unfortunate incident occurred. Fire broke out at 2:30 a.m. inside the fulling mill and then quickly spread to the nail factory and the flour mill. The La Chapelle family rolled up their sleeves and rebuilt the entire milling complex in Lachine. The good years lasted only a while, however, as the agreement with the Séminaire de Montréal, the owner of the mills, came to an end in 1837 due to Mr. La Chapelle Sr.'s great sympathy toward the Patriotes. The Sulpicians didn't appreciate such support very much, as they avoided all conflict with the British authorities, which left them privileges related to their seigneurie. The water mills were therefore placed in the hands of brothers William James and Robert Knox, and the adjacent lands were sold during the following years. In 1869, the Knox brothers resold all the property to Hugh Fraser. However, he no longer operated the water mills, which had become obsolete once the industrial mills were set up in the area surrounding the Lachine Canal. During this walk, millers and windmills and water mills are mentioned frequently. Don't forget that bread was the staple food. William Watson Ogilvie, a gentleman farmer. Born on February 14, 1835, in the district of Côte-Saint-Michel in Montreal, William Watson Ogilvie was the son of Alexander Ogilvie and Helen Watson. During his youth, his uncle William Watson trained him as an inspector. William Watson Ogilvie's brothers established A.W. Ogilvie & Company, which would become a major mill before William Ogilvie joined them as an associate in 1860. Business flourished then not only in Montreal, but also in Western Canada, particularly for supplying wheat, which would be processed into flour. Then in 1892, he finally fulfilled his dream. W.W. Ogilvie purchased Somerville Farm, opposite the Lachine Rapids, a 180-acre plot of land in Bas-Lachine, which is the borough of La Salle today. He called upon architect Alexander Cooper Hutchison to build a Queen Anne-style villa known as the Ogilvie Manor. He had farm buildings constructed too, as well as cowsheds and barns. On that piece of land, as a gentleman farmer, he bred Ayrshire dairy cows of great renown. In 1895, Ogilvie was honored with a silver medal from the Société d'Agriculture Jacques Cartier for the best-maintained farm in the district. He was particularly fond of his Ayrshire cows. When he died in 1900, the name of each of the cows was carefully recorded in the inventory of his assets. For example, the 4-year-old pedigree cow named Margaret of Lesnesoc was worth $60. Pansy of Carston, of the same age, $40. And the 1-year-old cow named Glenora Lady, $30. His horses, however, weren't given the same consideration, as they were assigned an overall evaluation without any particular distinction. Frédéric Ligory Bihic, banker and farmer. The son of Louis Bihic and Elisabeth Lhomme d'Artois, Frédéric Ligory Bihic was born in Saint-Mathias-de-Rouville on May 20, 1845. After studying law at Université Laval, he was called to the bar in 1868 and went on to become Honoré Mercier's counsel for the Inquiry Commission on the Baie des Chaleurs Railway. But he made his fortune in the banking business. He was a co-founder of Banque d'Hochelaga. In 1875, he married Caroline Angélique Desaules, the only daughter of Louis-Antoine Desaules, seigneur of Saint-Hyacinthe, and nephew of Louis-Joseph Papineau. In 1902, he was appointed senator by Canada's Prime Minister Wilfrid Laurier, who entrusted him, the following year, with writing the Bank Act. Associated with Canadian financial interests, he was the founder of the General Trust of Canada in 1909 and a member of the board of directors of what was then called the Canadian National Bank from 1928 until he died in 1933. In 1909, he bought the Orchard and Doran farms from the municipality of the parish of Lachine, present-day La Salle. These farms were located near the entrance of the Montreal Aqueduct and became the Biique Estate, covering an area equivalent to the town of Hampstead. It wasn't until the 1960s that a housing complex was built there. Louis-Auguste Châtel, Mayor of La Salle, Secretary of the Lake Saint-Louis Bridge Corporation. Born on June 12, 1871, in Saint-Isidore-de-Prescott, Ontario, Louis-Auguste was the son of Olivier Châtel and Philomène Quenneville. He married Exilda Lalonde in October 1896. Then in July 1923, he married Marie-Anna Aubry, a teacher in Long Point. In 1921, he bought a summer cottage in La Salle before becoming a resident there 3 years later. Elected mayor of La Salle in 1925 for a two-year term, which was renewed until 1935, he became one of the first church wardens of the new parish of Notre-Dame-du-Sacré-Cœur, built in 1927. The warden administers the parish's material belongings. Each parish has a parish corporation that includes six wardens, the priest, and a coordinator. Obviously, they're all volunteers. Then in 1928, the Quebec government launched the idea of building a bridge connecting the island of Montreal to the South Shore. To do so, it created the Lake St. Louis Bridge Corporation, which would oversee its construction in the vicinity of Ganawage, and L.A. Châtel would serve as secretary of the corporation's board of directors. In 1935, after Mr. Châtel's 10th year as mayor of La Salle, the voters opted for his opponent, notary Armand Brosseau. During construction of the Honoré-Mercier Bridge, the residents had criticized Châtel for the low percentage of La Salle workers at the worksite. He had publicly stated that, as the work on the bridge was extremely dangerous, it would be preferable for local workers not to be part of the worksite team. The voters hadn't really appreciated his comments in the midst of an economic crisis. Napoléon Alfred d'Amour, the station master. The son of Napoléon-Édouard d'Amour and Henriette Sauvé, Napoléon Alfred d'Amour was born in Salaberry-de-Valleyfield on April 22, 1884. D'Amour began his career as an operator for the Grand Trunk Railway in Hawkesbury in 1903. He continued his work in Allendale in 1904 and North Bay in 1905 and 1906, prior to becoming station agent for the Canadian Pacific in Webwood from 1906 to 1909. Then he married Marie-Laurette Boudreau in Algoma, Ontario, on July 25, 1910. He rapidly settled in La Salle at Highlands train station from 1916 to 1947. He even went into politics for a short time and served as city councillor from 1921 to 1923 under Mayor Anatole Carignan. Then, in 1923, D'Amour quit municipal politics. In fact, in those days, his job as station agent amply occupied him. In addition to selling tickets to passengers, writing freight transportation documents, handling telegraph communications, as well as looking after mail carried by train, he kept the Highland Station in good condition. He even oversaw its heating. During the 1940s, he was in charge of a team of telegraph operators and clerks and was responsible for looking after the tracks in the CP rail yard. A number of companies in La Salle used the train to deliver or receive goods. Samuel Bronfman, one of the founders of Seagram's, the famous whiskey distillery, sometimes came to see him to ensure the safe transportation of his plant's production. The theft of whiskey bottles had to be prevented. But this did not keep the two men from exchanging a few jokes when they got together.
The De Lorimier and Bélanger families. Located at 9603 Boulevard La Salle, Maison De Lorimier-Bélanger was built between 1737 and 1784. Characteristic of the architecture of rural Quebec homes, with its 18th-century masonry, it was inhabited by Claude Nicolas Guillaume de Lorimier, dit Chevalier de Lorimier, a militia officer, merchant, and politician. He was a descendant of Marguerite Chorel and fought as a patriot in the Lower Canada Rebellion. In 1837, François Bélanger purchased it, and his descendants maintained ownership for six generations, and in particular, Joseph Bélanger and his son, François-Xavier Bélanger, who were municipal council members from 1915 to 1933, a family at the heart of the creation of La Salle life. What was the life of a notable wife like during this time? Let me tell you about Marie-Alphonsine Bernadette Legault des Lauriers. Married to François-Xavier Bélanger on November 28, 1907, in the parish of Saint-Ange-de-la-Chine, she will live in this house all her life. It had become the oldest house of La Salle, still called Bas-la-Chine then. Her principal task was to raise her children and take care of the house. At that time, Marie-Alphonsine Bernadette, like most women, was the queen of her household, and her husband was a man of influence in the community.
Cecil Platt Newman was born in Lachine on October 26, 1866. He was the son of James W. Newman and Marie-Joséphine Platt. On March 6, 1900, he married Elisabeth Caroline Chaput in St. Stephen's Anglican Church. A resident of Boulevard La Salle, this landowner had an orchard between Orchard Avenue and 90th Avenue. He was a municipal councillor in the parish of Lachine in 1911 and 1912, the year the city of La Salle was created under Mayor Henri Bergevin. Cecil Platt Newman was the first mayor elected in the new city. His two-year term was highlighted by the acquisition of Maison Brunning, which became La Salle City Hall in 1914. Mr. Newman ran in the next election against Cyril Charles Lapierre and lost by just two votes. Newman returned to politics in 1917 as city councillor and remained there until 1923. He passed away in 1952 in a city where residential, industrial, and demographic growth was booming. Jean Milot, edge toolmaker and pioneer. The son of Philibert Milot and Catherine Sononner, Jean Milot was baptized in Vermenton, Bourgogne, France, on November 11, 1624. He married Marie-Marthe Pinson on January 7, 1654, and then Mathurine Thibault on November 26, 1663, in Montreal. He worked as an edge toolmaker, specializing in manufacturing cutting tools. In 1653, he moved into a home on the shore of Rivière-Saint-Pierre. For a very short time, in 1661, he was captured by the Iroquois. On February 3, 1669, he purchased the 420 Arpent estate owned by René Robert Cavalier de La Salle, which became the site of Fort Rémy and the heart of the village of Lachine. He also bought, from Nicolas Moisan, dit le Parisien, a 60 arpent piece of land adjacent to the estate. The Milot family kept this heritage property for nearly 150 years. With the purchase of the estate, Jean Milot acquired the right to build a windmill, which was built in 1671. The mill would even be able to serve as protection in the event of Iroquois attacks. Then in 1672, he had a forge constructed and a building named Manoir Milot that would also have a bread oven. Milot maintained the right to mill wheat only a short time. In 1673, he sold his mill to the Sulpicians, seigneurs of the island of Montreal. From then on, the mill would be managed, as was right and proper, by the seigneur of Montreal, who hired millers to run the millstones and grind the tenants' wheat. William Fleming, the miller. William Fleming was born around 1786 in Scotland, where he probably married Janet Miller in a Presbyterian church. The Flemings had seven children, two of whom died before the age of six. They were a close-knit family. It was John, the eldest, who took over from his father when William Fleming passed away in 1860. He remained a miller until sometime near the end of the 1880s. But in the history of the Fleming family, it is important to note the legal battle between William Fleming and the Sulpicians concerning the right to produce flour. This right was tacitly acknowledged by the British regime in 1760. This battle clearly illustrates the profound social changes that occurred in the 19th century. From the time that William Fleming started to use his mill to grind wheat in order to convert it into flour, Jean-Henri Auguste de Roux, the superior of the Sulpician fathers, who were then seigneurs of the island of Montreal, initiated this legal battle against the miller. He claimed that the seigneur of the island of Montreal was the only one to have the right to operate mills to produce flour. This legal battle will last 10 years. The trial began on June 28, 1816, in the Court of King's Bench. The lawyers for the Séminaire de Saint-Sulpice de Montréal called for the demolition of the mill and compensation of £1,000 for the loss of miller's fees. On April 16, 1819, a decision by the Legislative Council disallowed the legal existence and rights of the Séminaire de Saint-Sulpice de Montréal. On April 18, 1821, Judge Reed of the Court of King's Bench dismissed the exceptions raised by Fleming's defense as peremptory. On June 20, 1822, the court ruled that the Séminaire's position was well-founded and gave orders to demolish Fleming Mill. However, backed by English-speaking businessmen, Fleming didn't see it that way, and so he appealed the decision. From 1822 to 1825, the 8 judges of the Court of Appeal heard the case. They could not agree on a decision. It led to a deadlock that in fact became a victory for Fleming. So, in 1827, Fleming reached an agreement with Mason William Morrison to build a 5-story, 50-foot-high stone house with foundations and a number of openings for an amount of £220 sterling. In the contract between the two parties, the word windmill was nowhere to be found. Fleming wanted to remain very discreet.
Marguerite Chorel, pioneering woman. Marguerite Chorel de Saint-Romain was the daughter of Sieur François Chorel de Saint-Romain, dit d'Orvilliers, and Marianne Aubuchon. Neither the place nor the exact date of her birth is known, but records show that she was 25 years old in 1695 when she married a French officer named Guillaume de Lorimier. Guillaume fathered 4 children with her, thus becoming the ancestor of all the de Lorimiers in North America. For her dowry, Marguerite's parents provided a stone house with surrounding land at La Chine. The house had been built as a trading post, and François Guimaud de Lalande had briefly run an inn there. But it had stood empty since the La Chine massacre in 1689. Needless to say, the building offered few amenities. An earthen floor, a ladder in place of stairs, and dirt everywhere. Before moving in, Marguerite had a solid floor installed, little knowing that archaeologists would pry it up 3 centuries later and find what, to their eyes, were all sorts of treasures. Her life was not always easy. Only 2 of her children reached adulthood, and Guillaume died in 1709. But the most interesting part began when she was widowed. Due to the frequent absences of her soldier husband, she had learned to run the farm, and until her death in 1736, she grew the business and made it prosper to ensure the future of her children and grandchildren. The house stayed in the de Lorimier family until the early years of the British regime. Then it passed into other hands as La Chine saw steady change. The canal dug nearby, the advent of steamboats, the railway, the early industries, the first summer homes. The old stone house adapted and survived. The successive owners, the Irish innkeeper Hugh Heaney, the Scottish Grant brothers, MacDonald, the apothecary, Retired Colonel Wilgris, the Curry family, remodeled the house to suit their tastes and needs, but they all no doubt appreciated it as much as Marguerite Chorel did.
Hugh Heaney, innkeeper. Hugh Heaney was an innkeeper at Lachine. Both of his properties are still standing. Heaney's inn is now a private home, and Maison Lebert Lemoine is part of Musée de Lachine. Little is known of Heaney's background other than that he was Irish and Protestant. It's likely he was one of the former soldiers who turned to innkeeping after the conquest. Public house operators had to maintain orderly conduct because the authorities imposed strict regulations to ensure the respectability of premises patronized mainly by unaccompanied British officers, merchants, and administrators, many unmarried or temporarily separated from their families. In the early years of the British regime, there were few English-speaking families in Canada, thus few young women to marry. That may be why bachelors like Hugh Heaney wed French Canadians, often daughters or widows of seigneurs or merchant traders. Heaney's wife, Madeleine, the daughter of merchant Charles-René Lepailleur and Madeleine Normand, was a descendant of Michel Lepailleur, a royal notary. She was also related to the de Lorimier, a prominent Lachine family that included many officers, administrators, merchant traders, and later, patriotes. At the time, Lachine was the point of embarkation for expeditions to the Outaoué region and the Great Lakes. Upon arriving at Lachine, Heaney bought part of the lakefront property owned by Louis Cuillerier. After taking possession on June 1, 1765, he had a large two-story stone house built, and on July 20th, he obtained an innkeeper's license. He soon expanded the business with a store and declared it the only concern able to meet the needs of upper country travelers and outfitters. The Heaney family's social ascent, begun with Hugh's marriage to Miss Lepailleur, continued for generations through solid alliances with prominent, mostly French-Canadian, families of dignitaries, politicians, jurists, and merchant traders. Sir George Simpson, Little Emperor of the Fur Trade. Under the Treaty of Versailles, signed in 1783, Great Britain was forced to recognize the independence of the United States. As new borders were set, the English and Scottish traders of Montreal were shut out of the market for furs from the Great Lakes and Illinois. In response, they founded the Northwest Company and turned to the far north, determined to challenge the all-powerful Hudson's Bay Company on its own territory. Lachine became their base of operations. It was in this context that in 1803, Alexander Gordon had a stone warehouse built to store furs and trading goods for the so-called Nor'westers. Competition between the two companies was fierce, especially after British settlers supported by the Hudson Bay Company founded a colony on the Red River. While the humans clashed, the animals were being critically overhunted and revenues began to decline. Finally, in 1821, the British authorities forced the rival companies to merge under the name Hudson's Bay Company and appointed a new governor, George Simpson. He was small of stature, but vigorous, and above all, autocratic, hence his nickname, Little Emperor. Simpson decided to administer all corporate operations from the island of Montreal and made Lachine his headquarters. His death, in 1860, marked the end of the fur trade reign that had begun with the brother-in-law associates Charles Lemoine and Jacques Lebert. Nazaire Pichet, diplomatic priest. The opening of the canal, its enlargement, and the construction of a railroad linking Montreal and Lachine transformed the old Saint-Ange parish. As a result of these changes, the village of Fort-Rémy was gradually abandoned. By 1850, only a few families were still living around the old church built in 1701. Some residents wanted to have a new church built on the bank of the canal, but they couldn't agree on a location. Quarrels broke out. In the end, Nazaire Pichet, the parish priest, appointed in 1860, managed to restore peace by proposing a site acceptable to everyone. The Saint-Ange Church opened its doors in 1865, standing adjacent to the Sisters of Saint-Anne boarding school facing the old canal. The Fort-Rémy Church was demolished. In short order, the area between 12th and 18th Avenues became the heart of a new village, soon to be town, encompassing the convent, church, schools, public market, and city hall, as well as the churches of Lachine's two main English-speaking communities, St. Stephen's Anglican and St. Andrew's Presbyterian. From then on, the sprawling municipal parish of Lachine, which stretched from Montreal to Pointe-Claire, became distinct from the village of Lachine centered around the old canal. Later, the village became a town, and the rural parish was divided into two other self-governing municipalities, Dorval in 1892 and La Salle in 1912. John Grant, Lachine's first modern entrepreneur. John Grant was born in Scotland around 1749, at a time of political upheaval. He immigrated to the province, later state, of New York in his early 20s and settled at Lachine shortly before 1780. Although he played an important role in Lachine's history, many details of his life are still obscure. His funeral may be the best indication of how highly he was esteemed by his fellow Lachiners, who formed a cortege and took turns carrying his coffin on their shoulders all the way from the village to the Montreal Cemetery. Grant initially specialized in the shipment of goods, mostly furs, between Lake Ontario and Lachine. This experience led him to transport hundreds of Loyalist refugees to Ontario after the American Revolution. It was daunting work, since entire families with all their possessions had to be moved to places where there were no roads or anything other than a few trading posts. But it put him on the road to the fortune he later made as the leading shipper and forwarder between Montreal and Lake Ontario. Along with other businessmen, Grant lobbied hard for a canal that would circumvent the Lachine Rapids. Sadly, he died in 1817 without seeing the project initiated. Over the years, Grant had bought up property in Old Lachine. His lands are now home to Lachine Borough Hall, St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church, Saint-Ange Church, and Lachine High School, the town's first Protestant high school, built in the late 1800s. John Grant's business success and civic commitment qualify him as Lachine's first modern entrepreneur. Thomas Dawes, Ruhr. Britons who settled in Canada after 1760 were disappointed to find that local beers were nothing like the ales and porters they were used to. And so, since imported brews were expensive, English immigrants like the Molson family began producing beers tailored to the tastes of their compatriots. In 1826, farmer and brewmaster Thomas Dawes... In 1826, farmer and brewmaster Thomas Dawes chose to settle on the banks of Lake St. Louis. In those days, Lachine was still a rural parish whose economy depended on agriculture, fur trade transport, and inland navigation. But the opening of the first Lachine Canal the previous year boded well for growth that Dawes predicted would surpass that of Montreal. The land Thomas Dawes bought, 26th to 29th Avenues, was not far from the mouth of the canal at 21st Avenue. Under the management of Thomas's sons James Powley I and Thomas Amos, and their sons and grandsons, the originally artisanal brewery became a modern industrial concern and the first of its kind in Canada while remaining a strictly family business for four generations. Believing that what was good for the brewery was good for Lachine, the Dawes family was active on all fronts. municipal affairs, river and rail transport, telephone, telegraph and tramway services, as well as philanthropic efforts for St. Andrew's Church, the Lachine Rowing Club, Lachine General Hospital, and other causes. The Dawes family also played a key role in convincing the Dominion Bridge Company to locate in Lachine in 1882. Additional evidence of the family's importance to Lachine's economy is that in 1853, the rail link with the pier and the ferry terminus at 21st Avenue was moved further west to accommodate the brewery. Until 1922, the brewery was the mainstay of the Lachine community. Many of the local fields were devoted to growing barley and hops, and the pastures were filled with black percheron. These horses, which were used to transport barrels of beer, were the inspiration for the famous Black Horse brand.